Good morning, and calling State Affairs to order at 9.06 a.m. Thursday, May 10th in the Resources Room. And present we have Representative Tuck, Representative Knopf, Representative Birch, and Representative Josephson alternate. There's no legislation before us today, but an oversight hearing or informational hearing on election security specifically relating to Alaska. This has been more than a half year in the coming for my office, and we've been in touch with a variety of experts from around the country, including Center for American Progress and NCSL, Center for Democracy and Technology, and of course have State of Alaska experts as well, including the Chief Information Officer for the State of Alaska. And it looks as though the Division of Elections is also available to ask questions. Suite of expertise. Going in order, we're going to hear from Wendy Underhill from National Conference of State Legislatures, Maurice Turner from Center for Democracy and Technology, and Danielle Root for Center for American Progress, which has recently released a 50-state report card on election security across the 50 states, in which Alaska tied for the best score in the country, which is great news. So first, Wendy Underhill. Ms. Underhill, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record. We have your PowerPoint pulled up, and please make your presentation.
Yes, I am here. I hear you just fine, and I imagine you're hearing me as well. I am Wendy Underhill. I work for the National Conference of State Legislatures as the Director for Redistricting and Elections, and I appreciate this invitation to be with you electronically today. Someday I hope to be able to be there in person. Election security is a key issue in virtually all the states, not just in Alaska, and that means that on our elections and redistricting team, we've spent most of our time in the last 6 months or even a year working on election security. So moving to the next slide, NCSL is a bipartisan organization. Perhaps all your members are familiar with us already. We do work for the legislators and legislative staff from throughout the nation.
And we do not... Ms. Underhill, very sorry to interrupt. If by any chance you're on a speakerphone, would it be possible to switch to a handset? We can hear you, but the audio quality is not great, and sometimes that's the culprit.
Okay. I'm using a headset, but let me switch to a handheld set. Hang on just a sec. Does that make it better?
Perhaps. Let's just run with it and see how it works. Please go.
Okay. Those are my two choices other than the speaker, which I wasn't going to try. All right, well, feel free to stop me as often as you need to, either for slowing me down or if we've got some audio issues or if you've got questions along the way. So I was going to just point out that NCSL does not make recommendations on policy issues. That's the job of the legislatures. But instead, we provide 50-state research on a bunch of different topics, election security just being one of them. And then the next slide, please. So I do plan in the next 15 minutes to do a quick national overview related to threats to election security and where they've shown up and where they might show up, and particularly about policy choices that you all might want to consider. I am not a security expert. You have Maurice coming along after me who is, so I'll stick primarily on the policy side. And I have broken my comments into five categories that you can see on the slide, and I'll give you a brief overview of each of those and then move on to policy choices. But before I do that, I want to say that election security seems like it's a new topic, but it really isn't new. A few months ago, I was in New Mexico, and I was told about a community that demolished an old building, and under the floorboards, they found lots and lots of ballots, all marked for one particular party, meaning those hadn't been counted in the election boxes, in the ballot boxes. So security has been an issue, whether it's cybersecurity or human security, for decades. And I guess I'd also say that security isn't a thing that you say, yes, we have security, or no, we don't. It's always relative to something else. Are we more secure than we were with the systems we had before? That's where we're trying to go. Okay, the next slide. This slide shows how voter registration come into being. And I want you to know that this and a couple of the other prettier slides were developed by Beth Laddock, who works at NCSL, and she is from Dutch Harbor. On the bottom of this slide, you'll see that registrations can come to the state through several different mechanisms, but they all do end up in the same statewide database. And nationally, new registrations come most through the Department of Motor Vehicles, and some states are automating that process, and I know that you all have automated registration for your permanent fund people, but we're seeing some movement on that front. Then the next most common source are those that come through online voter registration systems, and then paper ballots that are filled in and mailed back. And after that, we get some from voter registration drives when people stand outside the public library or the grocery store and collect them. And then there are people who go to the local election official and say, I'd like to register, and they do so in person. So on that center part, the statewide voter registration databases, those are constantly being updated by local and sometimes state officials. Depends on which state you're in. And then they are checked against other sources of data, and there are a number of sources within a state, and then there are also some out-of-state resources that that data can be confirmed against. The good news is that the registration process is separate from the voting process, and that means that if there is any messing around with voter registration, it doesn't mean that there's messing around with the actual counting of votes. But the bad news is that if bad actors do want to access and do get access through the voter registration system, they can cause some havoc. One thing they might be able to do would be to change or remove any individual records, and then you have voters showing up and there's no record for them and they're unhappy. Or perhaps they could even delete the whole database right before election day, and that would cause a huge disruption. Of course, the public doesn't make a distinction between registration and voting, so from the public's point of view, any touching on voter registration or voting itself all looks like it's the election system that's threatened. So let's go to the next slide, and we'll look at policy options relating to voter registration. Some states have same-day registration where a person can show up at a polling place on election day and register to vote and cast a ballot. And usually this is adopted because people are interested in increasing turnout, but this option does also provide a fail-safe for anyone whose registration, for whatever reason, human error or cyber attack, might be missing from the database. So it's a backup, even though it is a bit of a hassle. And same with provisional ballots. Those serve as a fail-safe method for registration. But I would like to talk just briefly about keeping voter lists clean, because good registration means good elections. There's a really tight tie between running things smoothly. And to do that, I mentioned earlier that data is checked with in-state and out-of-state sources, and Alaska is a member of the Electronic Registration Information Center, a national cooperative of states where data is shared amongst them and reports are sent back on a regular basis. So I'd say that being a part of ERIC is a part of keeping the list clean. Then we'll move on to electronic poll books, which are in use in some jurisdictions. I'm not sure about in Alaska. But if the poll book is an electronic one, the idea for security might be to make sure that there's a backup. So if the electronic connection to the statewide voter registration database goes down, there could be a backup either on paper or it could be on a laptop that stands alone. So the point would be that any intrusion into Internet capability on election day would not have an impact through electronic poll books.
And Ms. Underhill, I have a quick question on this slide. I'm actually not entirely certain if I know what poll books are. I think I have a sense, but could you describe what poll books are and the significance of electronic poll books?
Oh, sure. Thank you for asking that question. Throughout the last 80 years or so, generally speaking, jurisdictions have printed out everyone who is registered to vote into a paper poll book, and that's given to the folks who run the elections at the precinct level. And when a voter comes in, the voter says, I'm Wendy Underhill, and they look up my name, and then I sign on the poll book. They literally capture my signature right there. So it's the method for checking people in. So that data could be in paper, and paper is used probably still for at least half the nation, or it could be electronically accessed, and some people like to think that that's a good way to speed up check-in if lines are an issue. And those electronic poll books can either be a direct line to the statewide voter registration database. Wendy Underhill, is she registered? And yes, we see her, and they put a mark in saying, yes, I've come in to vote. Or it could be that it could be kept on a separate laptop, and then at the end of the day or certainly by the end of the week, all of that data would be uploaded back into the statewide voter registration database to give me vote credit for my vote.
Thank you.
So moving on from there, voter registration systems can be reviewed for security, and I think I'll leave that to Maurice to talk about what that might look like. But there could be a request for the state or for local election officials to do certain levels of security testing beforehand. And then I will say that you may or may not know that the federal government has released an extra $300 million to the states. And I'm going to guess that Alaska's share is $3 million, and this is money that's expected to be used for election security. And I'm noticing that other states are trying to figure out what to do with that, and updating their voter registration database is a item that some states are looking at. Most of them were developed in the mid-2000s, so they're either ready for major renewal or even a replacement.
And Ms. Underhill, I want to first recognize Representative Wold joined us at a 9:11 and Representative Ledoux at 9:14, and Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. Just quickly, you know, we had a first-time mail-in election for a local election in Anchorage, which is a significant population center in Alaska, and one of the problems was there's a whole lot of expired information. I mean, when you talk about maintaining clean voter lists, registration database, there seems to be a real reluctance to go in there and scrub that information, because everybody's kind of tiptoeing around, you know, compromising the public's right to be represented on a poll list. How do you, or have you seen any innovative practices in how to scrub a list of, you know, when people move and they don't notify a Division of Elections and they've got how do you fix that from your perspective, or have you seen anything innovative that would come to resolve that problem through the chair?
Thank you for that question. It's an excellent one, and all the states that think about moving towards more mail elections, whether they permit them just for local elections or go statewide, have that question. And that in that case, when all mail elections are at stake, then the voter registration list becomes doubly important, because you don't want to be printing out and mailing twice as many ballots as you actually have voters for. So there are ways to keep cleaning, keep scrubbing throughout the year, and those include checking the data that comes from the, death records. There's a better name for that in the state health information records from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And so let's say the Department of Motor Vehicles knows that someone has moved and they have that information. They can let the voter registration people know that, who can send out a postcard saying, we see that, according to DMV, you've moved to Dutch Harbor now. Is that true? And we'll change your registration. So it takes a lot of proactive before Election Day work to keep things clean. And I think that probably in most cases when you do an election, that work is extra, first do an all-mail election, that work is extra hard, and then it becomes somewhat easier as you are working just with clean lists. The state of Colorado is sort of an example of doing this, and I could put you in touch with the state election director there if you'd like to get some of the details on how they do that. They're very proud that they've gotten down to something like 1/50th of the number of provisional ballots being used because they've got the clean voter list. So maybe we can take that up separately, too.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please. Oh, Representative Ledoux has a question.
I came in a little bit late, so if you've already answered this question, my apologies. Are there any red states that have all-mail voting, or is it primarily blue states?
Thanks for that question. At this point, there are three states that have all-mail elections, and they're Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. Colorado is purple now in that one of our chambers is held by Republicans and one is held by Democrats. Did I tell you all I live in the Denver metro area? That's where I vote. So when I say our, I'm referring to Colorado. It was enacted when both chambers were held by Democrats. That was in 2013. There was then and continues to be a Republican Secretary of State. The one in place in 2013 opposed it, but the minute it went through, he said, let's just do this the very best we possibly can. And the current Secretary of State, Wayne Williams, is a huge proponent of this and would be happy to talk with you. And I want to go to Washington, which now has Democrats in both chambers as of just the most recent special election. But they have gone back and forth, and they've had their all-mail elections for since 2011, I want to say, maybe 2010. So it is a blue state now. I'm not sure what its makeup was when they made that shift. And then I will tell you that Utah is all but all male at this point. They are allowing the counties to make the decision. And the counties in 2016, I was all but one or two, used all-male elections, and it's expected in 2018 that all of them would be using it. I have not added them to our all-male election list because it is an option for the state, but that's worth knowing. And Hawaii is thinking about it. That's a Democrat state, and California is moving that way, and it's got Democrats in control. Montana has thought about this seriously because probably, like Alaska, the large distances make certain parts of running elections complicated. It has not been enacted there other than for local elections.
And if I may actually ask a follow-up on that subject, Utah, Montana, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, California, Hawaii, all of those are western states. Is there a reason that's so? Are there any eastern states considering this, or why the sort of western bias?
I've wondered about this, and I have maybe a couple of answers. And I'm going to say that it's probably mostly a cultural answer. There is the size, and there are some particular advantages if you're in a large rural place. So that's possibly a piece. But I'm going to say it's probably mostly cultural, that the older states have just not been as adventuresome with changing up anything about elections. Early voting came first in the West. Vote centers came first in the West. Top two primaries came first in the West. And I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting any of those are bad policies. I'm just saying that the West seems to have more of an appetite for change. And then I also think that when I talk to legislators in the East, they are more concerned with the kind of fraud where someone might take the ballot out of the mailbox. I don't hear that from people in the West. So either there's a longstanding tradition of that kind of fraud in the East, and therefore they're more sensitive to it. And when I say tradition, I mean that you can, I think back to Tammany Hall days, that there might have been more control over who were the local election officials and perhaps more skullduggery at that point. So that's what I've got for you, mostly cultural but also geographic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to add one more thing, and that is that I do hear from legislators. Indiana is a state that has some legislators, including one on the Republican side, who are interested in this, but there isn't any action yet there.
Please proceed.
I will continue then. So I'm going to move to the slide that says voting itself, and it's good we just had that conversation about all-male voting. You'll see I've got that. Well, it was meant to be where it says, oh, yeah, absentee mail voting. That's wrapped up in that. We noticed that a lot of states have more and more people requesting absentee ballots, which is sort of like them voting with their feet. They'd rather receive their ballot. And so if that happens enough and enough and enough, then the state starts to say, well, maybe we should move to all mail. But in terms of security, whether it's all mail or it's an absentee ballot that goes out to people, they're kind of equivalent. And then we have in-person voting, and that's typical Norman Rockwell image of a polling place on election day, but it could be early in-person voting at a local election office. And it really could be vote centers, too. That's also in-person voting, but a little bit of a different model I'm happy to mention. And then the last balloon I've got there is electronically transmitted ballots, and some people would call that Internet voting. And that's the one that triggers the most concern about security. And to address that, what I could say is that all states are required to send ballots out electronically to certain parts of their citizenry, and that would include primarily military and overseas voters. So outbound blank ballots are normal using the Internet. And about two-thirds of the states allow those voters to send them back in some electronic form. Often that's as an email attachment, but it can be through a portal, a web portal. And both of those options do cause concern for cybersecurity people. Email attachments apparently can be hacked and changed. That would be a one-by-one change. And then that portal not only would allow the votes to come back in, but could become a target of an attack. There is a trade-off with any of these things, whether it's in-person voting or the vote centers or the absentee voting. There's always a trade-off. Maybe there's a security issue, but you get something different. So in terms of all mail elections, the trade-off might be that Native Americans in particular may not have access to private mailboxes, or people in rural areas might have really spotty mail delivery. So you got to notice that there's some good on one side and some bad on the other. And in terms of the electronic transmission, those overseas voters may not be able to get a ballot back in any other way. And some states are allowing people with disabilities or first responders to send them back that way as well. So now I'll go to the next slide.
Mr. Chair.
So for policy options that relate to how people vote, I divided it into three different slides.
If you can hear me.
With me, they're going to...
Sorry to interrupt. There's a question from Representative Tuck.
And I may have missed it, but when we look at in-person voting and in voting centers, how is that different?
Thank you for that question. I did not explain how that was different, so this is a good opportunity to do so. So in the traditional in-person voting, a person must show up at their specific precinct. You vote at the church on that corner. With a vote center model, everyone in a county, and I think you call those boroughs in Alaska, but whatever the jurisdiction might be, everyone from that jurisdiction can vote at any vote center, not just the one that has their, that used to have their name associated with it. And by using electronic poll books or some other methods, they should be able to get their accurate ballot from any of those vote centers. So this is supposed to be more convenient for people because they can vote on their way to the office or on their way to school or whatever it might be. They don't have to vote at the church on their corner. And it saves money, and it saves because you don't have to have as many facilities, and it also lessens the need to come up with poll workers. And I don't know if this is true in Alaska, but many states say that getting poll workers is almost the hardest part of running elections. So it's a big box version of a in-person voting option.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so on the slide that says pre-election policy options, I've started with require more training, and that training would be primarily for local election officials, but it could potentially be for poll workers too. And I have seen a steady increase in the number of states that require this or offer voluntary new training. And I think the really new piece here is that it could include parts about cybersecurity, such as how to avoid phishing attacks. But the plain Jane information that could be in there is how to do chain of custody for the ballots so that they're always handled by bipartisan teams, how to do physical security for the equipment, such as having cameras or locks, that kind of a thing. So training helps a lot on the human factor side of things. Then most states do logic and accuracy testing, which is done right before the election day. So you run a test deck, a set of ballots, and they're marked for George Washington and Abe Lincoln, and you know in advance what the count is going to be, and you run those through, and sure enough, the machine tells you the exact same thing that you knew from having designed that deck, and then you know that on that day, the machine is counting properly. And there, it's kind of nice to invite the public in. The public gets a sense of, oh, they're taking good care of this, and it builds a culture of transparency. And then the right time to do contingency planning is before there's a problem, so that would be in the pre-election phase. And this is probably happening in terms of cybersecurity at the state level and then also at the election level. I don't know whether it's appropriate to ask local election officials to have a contingency plan of their own or if that's something that comes from the state. But is there a plan in case something, a natural disaster or a cyber disaster happens? And last on this slide, each state can review its certification requirements. And by that I mean that every state is responsible for what they will permit in terms of voting technology in their state. And these are not often reviewed and updated, but when states are doing this, some are requiring that paper ballots be created. Others are adding a requirement that there be no internet connectivity for the voting equipment, and others are taking out obsolete references that might be to lever machines or that identify certain font size that they want for the ballot. So there's just a review that could be done to see if it's up to date or if it even allows you to buy whatever the next generation of equipment is.
And Ms. Underhill, I want to do a time check, given two more presenters on the line.
Yeah.
Is it possible to perhaps maybe hop to the slides that might be most relevant to security today, just to be able to make sure we get to all our presenters?
Yes. Let me think about this for a minute. Let's go to the next slide, which is Election Day. And here you can require that there not be any Internet connectivity. That might be the most important thing there. Some states are concerned about crime. Then let's go to the next slide. And on this one, I'm going to highlight the post-election audits. That's a surprisingly hot topic right now, and it is something that legislatures do determine. And a post-election audit is a way to confirm that the tabulating equipment did count the votes accurately. And Alaska does have a law of this nature. There are more sophisticated ones and less sophisticated approaches, but they all do require a paper ballot or at least a paper record to do that. And then let's go to the next slide. There's just some images of some current voting technology that's being used. I've mentioned paper ballots a couple of times. I'd also like to add in that sometimes these days voting equipment produces not so much a paper ballot, but a record of how a person voted. So it will give you the winning candidates, but not all the candidates. And those have a barcode or a QR code at the top. And that's a question to discuss with cybersecurity people. Is that sufficient? Because the barcode or the QR code is what gets read by the counting system. And even though it might say Abraham Lincoln, is that in fact what that barcode is reading? So just a question. And I do think it's important to point out here that people with disabilities have a federally protected right to vote securely and privately, and that as more people are voting at home, that changes a little bit the interest in having systems that they can use at home to mark a ballot, even though it's going to be a paper ballot. I think I'll just skip over the results reporting, and the reason I'll do that is that those are unofficial results, so it's not good if someone monkeys with the results as they're coming from the local office to the state and then out to a website or, you know, into the press. It's not good if there's a problem, but it doesn't change the outcome of the election. And then the disinformation. On this slide, I just want to point out that we had just a couple of days ago, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee referred back to all of the activities in 2016 as an effort to undermine confidence in the voting process. That was a quote. And then it went on to say that the committee has not seen any evidence that vote tallies were manipulated or that voter registration information was deleted or modified. So that has to do more with the campaign side of things and social media and hacks into emails and not so much with the vote counting. So I think in that context, I would just say the best defense is to have a communications plan about it. And then I've got resources. We don't have to talk about those. I can send those all to you. And then my contact information, maybe the most important resource that I have to offer is my staff, Dylan Lynch and Patrick Papiandi, and I are all happy to take calls on this.
Thank you very much, Ms. Underhill, for making the time in the presentation and all your help and correspondence with my office. Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you again. And we'll move to our next presenter, Maurice Turner with the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C. Mr. Turner, if you can, put yourself on the record. We're pulling up your PowerPoint, and go ahead and proceed.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair, and members that are there in the audience and anyone else who's watching via the live stream. My name is Maurice Turner. I am the senior technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and I'm calling in today from Washington, D.C. I'll go ahead and jump right into it. I'm going to be fairly brief, so that way there's plenty of time for questions. My goal is to cover threats to the voter registration systems, threats to voting itself, and then I'm going to go ahead and wrap up with threats to reporting the results. So when it comes to threats to the voter registration, I think the article in the Alaska Daily News was a great example of what can happen when an attacker probes a network and finds a vulnerability. So when we're talking about threats to the voter registration, we're talking about what does it mean to actually have an unauthorized actor go in and change information in the voter registration database. Some of the ways they might be able to get in, they might be able to access the local IT infrastructure or any cloud-based IT infrastructure that the state or the counties might contract for. One of the ways that they can get in there, one of the potential security gaps, would be through phishing. Phishing is where an individual with access is called the local IT administrator or the election official, someone who has legitimate access to those voter registration databases, receives an email that looks like it's legitimate, but it's actually an attempt to get the username and password for that particular person and impersonate them so they the malicious actor can go in and get access. That is probably going to be the most likely threat when it comes to any attempts to gain access to the voter registration databases. Another way that the registration database can be disrupted is through targeting that IT infrastructure that I talked about before. So actually trying to bring down the infrastructure such that the local jurisdictions don't have access to the state or cloud-based infrastructure. Now, local election officials are typically pretty good with their contingency plannings, especially given the fact that for a very long time, paper was the only way to conduct elections. So my expectation is that there should be some muscle memory there in how to run elections using paper, especially if those paper records are available as a backup. Are there any questions about threats to the voter registration database?
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your comments and presentation this morning. I had a question. In here in Alaska, we've got you've got like a front end, the World Wide Web that everybody sees, and then you've got a back end that would basically maintain and manage those records. Typically, those aren't really directly connected to each other. And I just wonder if you had some insight or perspective on. That seems like that would be a pretty standard practice, whether you're in banking or anything else. I was wondering if you could speak to that, to where you've got obviously a secure election database or in banking case, secure, bank records, and then you have the what's presented to the public, if you will, on a website that is generally accessible. And I just wonder if you could speak to how those are disconnected or connected for that matter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly the best practice is to make sure that those systems, the front end and the back end system, are disconnected and that the data is only transferred on a periodic basis, whether that be at the end of the day or for maybe some more high volume systems periodically throughout the day. It is definitely not a good idea to have the front end system connect to the back end system directly and continuously such that any user to that front-end public-facing website would have the ability to read and write to that database on the back end.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, do you have further comments or presentation, Mr. Turner?
Not on the voter registration side, so I'll go through to the next step, which would be threats to the voting itself. Now, when it comes to voting itself, there are typically going to be three areas where we'd be talking about security procedures. Those would be administrative controls. Those would be your typical policies and procedures and administrative functions. There are your technical controls. And then there are also the physical controls. The idea there is to make sure that there are no gaps in any of those controls, because if you have very strong technical controls, so you have the best IT systems there, if you have very strong physical controls, let's say you have cameras all over the facilities and the strongest locks you can buy, those are meaningless if you don't have the appropriate administrative controls in place such that you have your staff trained on the appropriate policies and procedures in order to properly implement those technical and physical controls. So you really do need to have all three of those types of controls in place in order to have an effective security plan when it comes to the voting itself. Now, some of the potential security gaps were already covered by Wendy before, the most important of which is the paper trail. So having some measure of accountability when it comes to the vote record through a paper trail, so that paper trail can be audited. Without the paper, an audit is just not possible. And as Wendy mentioned before, The trend is to go toward the best practice of a risk-limiting audit. And that's something that I'm happy to explain to you at another time, because it is definitely a separate body of work. But just know that if you do not have a paper trail, you cannot have an effective audit. Other security gaps to be concerned about, as Wendy mentioned before as well, accessibility features. Those are protected by federal law. Accessibility features are sometimes not part of the design process, and so they may be added on at the end of the process, which may be exploited because those accessibility features need to be in place in all voting systems. So gaps may be there if they are not, if the accessibility features aren't part of the design process when the voting systems are being developed. Two more security gaps to be concerned with are malware. So that would be malicious code that is introduced into a voting system, whether it comes through a wired networking connection or through a wireless networking connection. The malware can be introduced onto the voting systems, and that can cause enough disruption such that voters would not be able to actually cast their ballot, or there's potential for that record to be changed. Now, last summer at the DEF CON hacking convention, the largest hacking convention in the world, took place in Las Vegas, there was a voting machine hacking village. CDT was part of the planning for that, and we found that every single voting machine that was available, and there were several different models that were available, were subject to having vulnerabilities exploited, and they were successfully hacked. The first machine actually did have a Wi-Fi network built into it such that when it was turned on, it automatically started broadcasting its own wireless network, and that particular voting machine was hacked from two rooms away within about 10 minutes.
And can
so that is what we mean when we talk about... Go ahead.
And just to jump in, I'm not familiar with what Alaska's voting machines are, but you mentioned every single voting machine available was at this hacking village. And would that include the type of voting machine that Alaska uses? Or is Alaska analog that it didn't make it?
Not every type of voting machine that is available across the country was at the DEF CON voting machine hacking village. There were some models that were there, but every single model that was there on site was successfully hacked.
Thank you.
I'll provide you with another example of how malware can disrupt in a large IT infrastructure. The city of Atlanta, Georgia, recently was hit with very bad malware. It came through as what's called ransomware. That's where the type is a specific type of malware that is installed by a malicious actor onto a system, and it spreads as quickly and as far as possible. And what the user sees is a screen that pops up and says, please go ahead and send some money to this particular address because we've encrypted or locked up all of your data, and you won't be able to access it unless you pay the ransom. Well, as it turned out, the ransom was, I believe, less than $50,000. But the city was unable to pay it for a variety of reasons, and they ended up spending over $2 million in recovery and remediation because several systems were offline for a number of weeks. So malware sounds like at the start they can be very small, and it is, but then they can spread and have a massive impact. The last security gap when it comes to threats to the voting process itself is information silos. Information silos are what happen when information stays just within a particular department or organization. Now, this is something where the FBI, DHS, state, county, and even city officials are recognizing the benefit of being able to share information up through all levels of government and then across to different jurisdictions to make sure that if something bad happens in one jurisdiction, it can be prevented in other jurisdictions. And that's really the critical message that I want to send out today, is that DHS is really stepping up and doing a much better job of working with a number of different states and their elected officials to ensure that information is shared as broadly as possible, so that way if something does happen in one jurisdiction, it can be shared with the other jurisdictions. Are there any questions there about the threats to the voting process itself?
Yeah, I have a high-level question, which is, given what you might know about Alaska's voting and election systems, what would you highlight as the big ol' single vulnerability in our system that you're aware of, and also what would be your foremost recommendation for improvement to the security of our election system?
I'm actually very impressed with Alaska's election system. As we heard before, the cap grade was a B, and so I think Alaska's on the right track when it comes to being prepared. I would say there needs to be some additional thought considered when it comes to making sure that only the appropriate people have access to systems. And what I mean by that is, quite frankly, ensuring that two-factor authentication is used at the local level to ensure that even though, it may be used at the state level, that the local election officials are protecting their own legitimate access to their election and voting systems.
Thank you. Were you going to add anything more, Mr. Turner?
I'm going to discuss the threats to the reporting results themselves. So that'll be the last of my 3 points I'd like to make.
And before we get to that, let me go to a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, regarding the question regarding voting machines, I think our machines were basically purchased in about 1998, which would I think that's around 30 years ago. I don't know that was pre-Wi-Fi, but it was probably pretty close. And I think the equipment we have now is old and tired, but it does permit a hard copy ballot to be retained, which, at least for my mind, you've got a hard copy record of that vote. But I don't think there's any... I don't think there's any a point or an intersection, if you will, between the voting machine and the internet, to my knowledge. And I'm just wondering if that technology, even though they're 30-year-old machines, is there newer technology that uses a similar capacity where you optically scan the ballot and report those numbers, but you retain the ballot through the chair?
Well, if your machines are as old as being purchased in the late 1990s, my assumption is that there is not any network connectivity. I will say this, that typically newer machines are going to be commercial off-the-shelf or COTS. So it would be incumbent upon the purchasing department to make sure that there is thorough vetting and the ability to thoroughly test any new machines that are going to be purchased. So whether that testing is done by state staff or it's done by contractors, it's important to be able to have a level of assurance that whatever new machine is going to be purchased, that it can be tested to make sure that there are no functions or features that the state of Alaska doesn't want. For example, there may be an instance where a decision is made to not have any network connectivity, but that particular functionality is still within the machine. So if the only control over that network access being turned on or off is in software, the same way you would turn on or off the Wi-Fi on your laptop or on your phone, that could be a point where a malicious actor could come in and gain access to the machine and then turn it in access to the machine locally and then through software turn on that network connectivity. So having a procurement process that is fully informed and aware of what the purchasing options are and what the desired specifications are is crucial.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any sort of a sense as to the number of voting jurisdictions where a paper ballot is retained in addition to, you know, in other words, there's a hard copy ballot where somebody, you know, filled in an election box, and that record is actually retained in addition to the optically scanned image? Mr. Chair?
I do not have that information for you, but I am happy to go ahead and get that information at a later date.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
And please go ahead, Mr. Turner, on the third part of your presentation.
Sure thing. So last thing I'm going to discuss threats to the reporting results. And this gets into the previously mentioned Senate intelligence report, in which it was stated that the goal of the Russian influence campaign was really to sow doubt through spreading misinformation. So one of the ways to combat that type of activity is to make sure that only dedicated devices are used for the election process, whether that's dedicated servers on the public-facing front end, whether that's dedicated USB flash drives that are only used one time and only used one way to ensure that there is no way to compromise the information that's contained on there. What we're likely to see when it comes to threats to the reporting results are two things. One, as I said before, is going to be the misinformation. So think about reporting out unofficial results, most likely through social media. Secondly, we're likely to see denial of service attacks, or DDoS. A denial of service attack is when many hundreds or even several thousand machines all around the internet are focusing their requests on just the one, in this case, let's say the state of Alaska's reporting website, to the point that legitimate traffic can't get through, and if something looks like the server hosting that reporting website is taken offline. Now, there are services like Cloudflare's Project Athenian or Google's Project Shield that can help protect against these types of automated DDoS attacks. But the real goal is to make sure that there is a plan in place for getting those unofficial reports out if there is a denial of service attack. So that can be through social media, that can be through traditional media or press releases, or even television or radio. So what is the actual plan if the reporting results website is taken offline through denial of service attack or some other type of misinformation is reported out? How would the state go about reporting the actual information and getting that truthful information out ahead of the misinformation that is reported?
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Turner?
That is all for now. I want to make sure that there's plenty of time for any follow-up questions you might have as it relates to threats to reporting the results or any of the other more technical questions you have about cybersecurity when it comes to elections.
I'll look to the committee for questions and note we have one last presenter. Any further questions for Mr. Turner? Seeing none, thank you very much for making the time. And if you have any follow-up information to Representative Birch's question, please send it to Kathy in my office, with whom we've been corresponding. We can circulate it to the committee. Finally, we have Danielle Roof with the Center for American Progress. On members' desks is a report card that the Center of American Progress did of all 50 states and their election security. Alaska received a B. It was tied for best in the nation with, I think, 8 other states or something like that. And Ms. Root is here to speak to that report card and the recommendations contained within. Ms. Root, please put yourself on the record and proceed with any testimony.
Great. Thank you guys so much for having me. I hear that spring has finally arrived in Alaska, so happy spring to you all. I will keep my comments brief and look forward to any questions you may have. So in 2016, cyber operatives, namely Russian hackers, took unprecedented steps to infiltrate and disrupt state and local election systems across the United States. National security experts and state election officials do not know the full extent to which hackers breached election infrastructure, and so far there is no evidence that election outcomes were manipulated or altered. However, it is known that hackers attempted to breach the election infrastructure of at least 20 states, including Alaska. For example, Russian operatives reportedly probed Alaska's election-related databases in the weeks leading up to the 2016 elections, and as Maurice alluded to earlier, the infamous hacker CyberZeist gained unauthorized access to Alaska's elections website on Election Day. In that case, built-in cyber defenses prevented the hacker from altering data or causing service disruptions. However, hackers armed with more sophisticated techniques may try again. The American people have been warned that attacks on election infrastructure have and will continue in future elections, including the upcoming 2018 midterms. Unfortunately, a wide range of national security experts, cybersecurity experts, policymakers, and others agree that state and local election systems continue to be ill-equipped to withstand attacks from hackers and foreign adversaries like Russia. In February 2018, the Center for American Progress published a comprehensive review of the election security preparedness in all 50 states and D.C., detailing the continuing vulnerabilities of state election infrastructure and assigning grades based on election readiness. Alaska was one of only a handful of states that received a B, the highest grade awarded. Alaska earned points for adhering to minimum cybersecurity best practices related to voter registration systems and for its widespread use of paper ballots for conducting elections, two key areas of election security. Despite this, there remain vulnerabilities in Alaska's election infrastructure that leave the state open to election-related attacks and must be addressed. One area needing improvement is Alaska's post-election auditing procedures. Currently, the number of ballots included in Alaska's post-election audits are based on a fixed percentage, as opposed to a statistically significant number tied to the margin of victory of one or more ballot contests, as is common with risk-limiting audits. These are considered the gold standard of post-election audits, as was mentioned by both Maurice and Wendy earlier in the presentation. So many, many states are looking to moving towards requiring risk-limiting audits, and we recommend the same for Alaska. Tying the number of ballots included in a post-election audit to the margin of victory rather than a fixed percentage or number ensures that enough ballots are examined to create convincing evidence that the outcome is correct. And it also saves resources by guaranteeing election officials only examine the precise number of ballots necessary. Alaska's post-election audits also do not include uniformed and overseas citizens absentee or UACABA ballots. In 2016, UACABA ballots made up more than 8,000 of all ballots cast in Alaska during the presidential election. CAF recommends that all ballot types, regular, early voting, absentee, provisional, and UACABA, be eligible for inclusion in post-election audits. This is because by only auditing certain categories of ballots, election officials may fail to detect anomalies in the tabulation of other ballot types. Furthermore, Alaska should terminate its use of electronic absentee voting. Alaska is the only state allowing any eligible voter to return a voted ballot electronically. And although it's good that Alaska has moved away from the use of web portals, the state still allows voted ballots to be returned via fax. And as Wendy mentioned earlier, election security experts and computer scientists have long warned that returning ballots by fax is insecure and subject to hacking and a myriad of ballot delivery problems. Voters deserve to have the security of their ballots protected and for their ballots to be counted as the voter intended by having them transmitted through the mail so there is a paper record of intent instead of through vulnerable internet transactions that put the security of their ballots at risk. Alaska was awarded $3 million as part of the 2018 HAVA Election Security Fund to bolster its election preparedness. And while it's good that the state plans to use this funding to replace old voting machines and bolster cybersecurity protections, It should also consider using some of the funding to strengthen Alaska's post-election auditing procedure and require all voted ballots to be submitted in person or returned by mail. By taking these steps, Alaska can significantly improve its election security preparedness. Thank you all very much, and I am open for questions.
Are there questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if your audit happened to look and see what the percentages of ballots that were returned electronically. You, by any chance, you have that number?
So that's an excellent question. That information does not appear to exist anywhere. So the Election Administration Commission, or they track how many UACABA ballots are returned by each state, or in each state, each election cycle, but they don't track how many of those ballots are returned electronically. I know some advocacy groups are trying to collect that information through FOIA requests, but there is no publicly available information about how many ballots are submitted electronically each election cycle, either nationwide or by state, unfortunately.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Root, so I'm kind of, when you're talking about security, what do we, and you're referencing ballots being returned by fax or electronically, so what are we looking for? I mean, is it a voter privacy issue? Is there the opportunity for manipulation of the ballots? I mean, I'm not much of a privacy guy. I don't particularly care who sees how I vote. So I guess when you're talking voter security, what exactly are you? I don't want to ever get to the point where something can be manipulated, but when you're returning something by fax, is it a privacy issue, or what's the concern there?
Sure. So it completely depends what via fax means for the state. So some states, faxes go over the internet, and that's how they're returned. Other states, they use the old-fashioned dial-up, all that jazz. If it's internet, if it's returned via internet, we are concerned about manipulation. In all cases, if a ballot is returned via fax, we are concerned about service disruption. So any kind of attack that could prevent a voted ballot from actually being received by election offices and being counted. That's what we're really concerned about. And, of course, there can be issues with ballot delivery by mail. Sometimes mail service can be unreliable. But if there is a large number of ballots being returned via fax, one attack that could result in service disruptions could result in many, many, many people not having their ballots counted.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are probably going to be pretty basic questions, but going through the audit synopsis, UOCAVA, what does that mean?
So it's the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Ballots. So those are ballots that I believe Wendy actually touched on this earlier. So state governments or states are required to send out electronically or via the mail ballots to U.S. citizens who are stationed overseas or live overseas for elections. But there is no requirement that the state allows or requires these ballots to be returned electronically. So that's really where the state practices differ.
And then if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm trying to guess, but under these, the voter verified paper audit trail, we use a DRE machine with VVPR. I'm thinking VVP stands for voter verified paper, but she can explain that acronym as well.
Yep, so it was either Maurice or Wendy who talked about this. This is the electronic machines that print a kind of receipt of the voter's choice. So typically how this works is the voter selects their candidate or ballot initiative choice on a touchscreen or dial machine of some kind. They have the opportunity to view their decision behind a plastic or glass viewing window, and then at that point confirm that the printed ballot receipt that they see matches what they chose on the touch screen. And once they click yes or submit, then that is preserved, and something that election officials can go back to and review through audits for whatever other reason. The reason that election security experts Guild recommend those and actually recommend paper ballots above those is because not all voters actually check that paper receipt before submitting it. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Great.
Any further questions for Ms. Root? And at this time, I see Director Behnke has joined us, and I had at least a couple of questions for the Division of Elections, if there was someone available. And I should also note that Mr. Vada, the Chief Information Officer for the State of Alaska, is here as well, maybe to help identify who may be the right person to answer the questions. Or some of my questions relate to the state's perspective on some of the recommendations that were just made by Ms. Root and the Center for American Progress. Would somebody be available to testify? Brief at ease. Kurt, and thank you, Ms. Behnke. I know that you were just in Anchorage with 2 days of busy meetings and got back late, so thanks for joining us this morning. I just had a couple of questions relating to Ms. Root's presentation, and wanted to ask on two subjects. The first, what the Division of Elections' perspective on implementing risk-limiting audits is, as Ms. Root testified, and the second being if there are plans on the works about changing the state's practice of accepting ballots submitted by fax, for whichever of the three of you would be best suited for either, any of those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Josie Behnke, Director of Elections. Thank you for having us this morning. We just got back from Anchorage after a technology fair with 4 federally certified vendors. And so looking at new election technology, and of course, security is election security on the mind of everybody. So we're happy to be here and just want to address 2 things. You asked about the risk limit audit and also the return of electronic transmission of ballots online. So first of all, the risk limit audit is something that we as a division have looked at through the state of Colorado. It's a fairly complex process. I'm under the impression that, and I could be wrong, but that maybe the number of voters in Alaska, we have a very robust audit process, and I'm happy to go into that with you, but certainly it seems like that seems to be kind of an innovation for states to move in that direction. Colorado's adopted it among maybe other states as well, but so we've looked at it, and we're aware of it, and we're, learning more about the process. Secondly, your question about what the division is doing to limit the electronic transmission of ballots. And so under UOCAVA, under federal law, we're required to allow for the return of ballots online and online or by fax. And so one of the Center for American Progress has reported that was kind of a weakness in our system. And due to the ongoing cybersecurity concerns, the division made the decision earlier this year to suspend the return of those ballots online. However, we still will allow those to return from overseas, and you know, here statewide or nationally to allow voters to return those ballots via fax or by mail.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux?
So in other words, you can get your ballot online, but you have to return it by fax or by mail.
Correct.
So what was there a time that you could actually return it by internet? Because I don't remember that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes.
Through the chair. What election was that? When?
I believe starting in 2014 was when we first implemented that. So for 2014 and 2016, you could voters could receive their ballot online and also return it online.
And I can just comment. I do remember that because I had friends who were in college who returned their ballots by email. But anyway, Representative, we'll do a follow-up.
So you're going to allow them by internet now only if they're the overseas ballots?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we accept or we can provide online ballots to voters, whether they're overseas or in the state or, you know, from anyone. We don't restrict it just to UOKAVA voters.
But what I'm saying is there any, through the chair, is there any group of people or, you know, geographic area in which you will continue to allow the ballots to be returned through internet?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the division has made the decision to suspend that practice due to ongoing cybersecurity threats that have been, that have been on the news and have been, you know, made that we've been made aware of. Until there's a more secure solution.
So it's suspended for all groups, period. Save the nay. Thank you.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. First of all, there's some testimony about the potential for disruption of faxed-in ballots, for lack of a better term. Do you have a sense of whether the last election cycle we had, you know, 50 or 500 or 5,000 faxed in ballots, and I don't have a sense for, you know, how big a number that is that we should be concerned about. And do we have?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I don't have the precise number. It wasn't maybe under 1,000.
Under 1,000. Okay. Follow up.
We've
also had some discussion regarding the basically the competence, if you will, and the audit trail that's left by our 30-year-old voting machines, the 300-plus of them that we still own and operate, because it does have a paper ballot. Two questions. First off, how is that information transferred from a remote location? Is it like a with a, you know, a zip drive, or is it possible? It seemed to me, it stuck in my mind that it was possible to use a modem or some sort of electronic. But how does the information get from a remote Alaska location, say Nome? How does that data get to Election Central in the election process? Is it physically moved, or is it transmitted over a line somehow?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I don't consider Nome that remote, but but I have Philip Melander, our systems administrator here, that can maybe describe how that information is transmitted.
Perfect. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Philip Melander. I'm systems administrator for the Division of Elections. So through the chair, Representative Birch, that information is transmitted back via the phone lines. So either verbally or via a modem.
So there is an electronic connection, a through wire connection somehow,
yeah,
or phone line or otherwise. And I guess the question would be, how is that susceptible to any sort of, I don't know if that qualifies as an internet connection or not, but I would be interested in your perspective on that, through the chair.
So through the chair, Representative Birch, it generally we do not consider that an internet-related connection. Every system has some vulnerabilities, but the risks in that area are considered relatively low.
And to maybe confirm my understanding of how it works, be it Gnome or Shishmaref or wherever, the election results are, when you say transmitted verbally over phone line, they're called in. Is that effectively what we're talking about?
So, yes, Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow up. To the extent that the voting equipment that we've utilized over the last 30 years, what is there? Have you been looking at competing vendors that offer a similar capacity with basically a paper ballot, record ballot, that's audit trail, and then some sort of electronic scanning, optical scan, and then transmittal through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Birch. So we had four federally certified vendors at our technology fair, and all of them have a paper ballot. And so, yes, I don't see Alaska moving away from that.
Okay. Lastly,
go ahead.
Training. I know there is some kind of a kerfuffle over the some of the remote locations and training. What sort of a training regime has been established to basically perfect the voting processes that we have in place and statute through the chair?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Birch. First of all, the issue of training, by statute, the director is required to submit a training plan to the lieutenant governor by March 1st of an election year. And so we have a copy of that, happy to provide you a copy of that. And so for 2018, since 2016, we have been working hard to improve every aspect of election management, and I think that election training is something that we've taken great strides to improve. Specifically, we've upped our in-person training, and also spent last month in the KTOO studio doing some more interactive training and making DVDs out of that. And so we'll have links to that on our website. So I feel confident that we've addressed that concern, and we're prepared for 2018.
Great.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ledoux.
So is anybody concerned that people who vote absentee, at least from a major city, get to vote for a longer period of time than people who go to the polls? In other words, I understand that the polls close at, I think it's 7 or 8 o'clock. But you can go down to the Anchorage International Airport and get something which is postmarked that same day. Now, I don't think that opportunity exists in Shishmaref. Probably doesn't exist in Nome. So, in effect, I mean, Anchorage voters can vote, whether they close at 7 or 8, I can't remember right now, have a 4 or 5 hour later window.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think access to the ballot, the importance of that is kind of central to my role as director. I think we're all, as a division, concerned about access to the ballot. Specifically to your question, I don't know. I don't have an opinion about that.
All right. And then I've got a second question dealing through the chair, a totally different topic. I was pretty surprised when the results of the latest Anchorage municipal election came out, not with the results, but the fact that it seemed like it cost more to do it by mail than it was to do it not by mail. Would you anticipate if the state went to all mail system that would end up costing more money instead of what I would have anticipated would have been less money.
Perfect timing.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. So yesterday we had the election policy work group, a group that the Lieutenant Governor has put together. We had a presentation from the MOA about their election costs and kind of a debriefing about what worked well, what didn't work well yesterday, similar to what the committee received here a couple weeks ago. And the issue of the cost of the election came up. For 2018, they were required to purchase new equipment and all the software, you know, related to in order to conduct an all-by-mail election. And so I think that's a cost that's contributed and won't be an ongoing cost. And so we talked about that yesterday. I think overall in our exploration of other states that do all-by-mail elections exclusively is that there have been realized cost savings proven in Colorado, specifically that we've looked at. And so I can share that information, provide that information to the committee if you'd like.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And just to clarify my own understanding, it sounds as though you're saying that the cost of the Muni's vote-by-mail election was driven by one-time upfront expenses that won't be repeated in future years?
Correct.
Okay. And I have one last question, which is one other recommendation Ms. Root made for Alaska was including all ballots, including UOCAVA ballots in post-election audits. And I wanted to ask if the division has a perspective on that recommendation or an intent to implement anything along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do.
Wonderful. Well, on that high note, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to the committee members and our guest presenters. And we've got 7 minutes to get to floor, so we will adjourn at 10:23.